This is Michael Conforti, October 8th, 2010. Dreams, expressions of eternal wisdom. Dreams are the language of the soul.
Thank you. Third invitation. I'm honored. Thank you. It's great to be back. I really had a good time the first two times. I felt people really interested in the material. And you know, when you feel it, it brings out the best in a speaker. So I hope I can do my work tonight. There are a number of things I want to talk about, you know, in terms of the working with dreams. And I understand that Dr. Krippner was here and some other people speaking about dreams in your last series. And some of you wonder, would it be too much to have the theme of dreams again, or would it be an interesting compliment? Now, I hope it's going to be a good compliment. I think Jung was far ahead of his time. I would imagine most people here tonight, not everybody, is because you've been touched in some way by Jung's life and by his work. And I think the thing that touches all of us about Jung is his acknowledgement of another domain. Call it the world of the spirit, the transcendent, that there's something else moving life. Some may call it la forza del destino, the force of destiny that moves life. And you realize there's something very subtle, or at times not so subtle, pushing you, guiding you, motivating you to do things, and you end up in places you never thought you'd be. And then there are other times you find yourself struggling against the currents of a destiny that's moving your life. And what a lot of the work is about that I'm going to introduce tonight, we're going to do much more detail tomorrow, is looking at the objective psyche. Now, the objective, now that's a tough word for a lot of us, because, you know, in science we say, well, Einstein gave us the theory of relativity, which means everything is relative, right? Heisenberg's uncertainty theory in physics. Schrodinger's cat, where they talk about it's all mysterious, one never knows, there's no facts. You look at quantum physics, and you say, well, in the world of the quantum, there's no form. Everything is ill-defined. It's all in a state of potential. Jung's psychology offers such a wonderful way to understand these phenomena, because he talked about the fact that there's a priori form in every living system. Now, there are some biologists that took up this mantle, or did it before Jung and after Jung. One, some of you know the work of Adolf Portman, a very, very well-known zoologist, that talked about preformed states in biological systems. And he realized that the adult form of an organism was already present at the beginning of life. And he made this beautiful quote, and a paraphrase, Portman, he says, I can understand why it was that the mystic said that the end is in the beginning is in the end. When you see that there's something already formed, you don't even know what it is, you can't even see with the electron microscope, but there's something there that's going to be used when the organism hits the adult life. It's the same with the human. Different things kick in later in life. And Jung was one of the first to say it's the same thing in human psyche, that there are these nodal points, these fundamental parts of the psyche that guide us throughout our life. Now, when we talk about things like relativity, and again, this is what gives us a lot of permission to say an image and a symbol can be anything we want it to be. And I'll tell you, I'm going to put my cards on the table early on, so there's not a lot of room for discussion about where does Michael stand on this. I think Jung would be really rolling in his grave today, or is rolling in his grave, with the direction that Jungian psychology has gone. I think he'd be rolling in his grave with a lot of the mystics and the wise ones and the holders of the wisdom traditions when they look at how we've begun to apprehend psychic phenomena, the transcendent, how we understand dreams, and the world of psyche. Because we've taken the world of the sacred and the profound, and we've made it into purely secular material. I mean, you can understand why it was that the first generation of Jungians were ministers and rabbis and priests and people that cared about the spiritual world. And about 3 years ago, when I was doing the brochure for the Assisi conference, something finally dawned on me, something you've probably known for years, but maybe I'm a slow learner. But I said that Jung's work on archetypes is really a way to understand in contemporary garb the eternal wisdom traditions. And if you think about what the wisdom traditions were about, you know, whether it's, again, the rabbis or the priests or Thomas Merton's Devic Fathers, they were talking about an understanding of life that far transcended just a temporal life. It's about your mother and your father, or about your feelings, about making a living. Now, all that is part of life. I mean, clearly, we need to negotiate these waters. But then you see there's something else here. There's something else. And when we look at an image, if you look at the tradition Jung taught us when he worked with imagery, he went back and he asked the question, what's the ontological? Can you hear okay in the back? No. Is this on okay? I should just be closer to it. You're asking an Italian to be stationary. I mean, this is great. This is funny. This is like I was doing a talk on forgiveness, and it said you're asking a Sicilian about forgiveness. We still deal with the vendettas. And there's a great little book called How to Be an Italian. And it says you want to be a Northern Italian, Southern Italian, or Sicilian. They say, if you want to be a Sicilian, the first thing you have to learn is how to hold a grudge for 20 years and not know why you got it. And it's true. I mean, my father, you know, God bless him, he's 94 years old, you know. And he says, you know, he can't come to my house for dinner. I said, how come? He said, well, I don't know. But he must have did something a long time ago that I'm still mad at, but I don't know what it is. But it must have been a good reason why he can't come. So, forgiveness. So I will try to be somewhat stationary, okay? I'll do my best. If you can't hear, please don't hesitate. Put your arm up or something in the back. Okay. Imagery. Jung spent his life looking at the roots of images. This is why he spent all these years studying alchemy, studying mythology, studying the world's greatest religions, religious traditions, fables. And I mean, many of you know the work of Marie-Louise von Franz, the grand dame of Jungian psychology, one of the most brilliant ever, who studied fairy tales for 30 years. Why would you do this? They were looking at eternal motifs and eternal patterns. A fairy tale begins. The little boy is lost on the side of the road. The little girl is doing something by the water, is picked up by the fisherman, picked up by the farmer. How many stories of heroes do we have, whether it's Superman coming from another planet, or the story of Moses going down the river, or the story of Jesus? You begin to find, you find what? If you're an investigator and you can say, I want to understand something about these stories, you find there's a high degree of regularity in these stories. Every mythic story has certain features. Now, those of you know a little bit about my work, for the past 6 years, I've been working as a script consultant in films. And what I do is I look at archetypal coherence in storylines. That there are certain things a character should do. A certain, not should do, but certain things that are characteristic. You know, we talked last night, my host drove me to the hotel last night, we were talking about it. Like the TV show Seinfeld. Everyone knows Seinfeld pretty much, right? Well, there are certain things Kramer's going to do, and Jerry's going to do, and Elaine is going to do, right? And when they begin to do things out of character, you say, I wonder why. Why is Elaine a good dancer? You know, Elaine can't dance. George is never mature, never has a decent relationship. Jerry is a constant joker. And there was one episode which was really very interesting. And the writer of that show is somebody I think is one of the most brilliant writers around, Larry David. Either you love him or you hate Larry David. Anyway, he had one episode where all the four characters, interesting, the number four, right? Symbolically, mythologically. The four characters did everything different. Elaine was a great dancer. Kramer was very sophisticated, right? Remember Kramer with the hair? And coordinated. He would never fall or bang into walls. George was a very sensitive, thoughtful guy, would never tell a lie. And it would watch you say, well, what is this show about tonight? This isn't Seinfeld. These are not the characters. And then in the genius of Larry David, he called, I think, the alternate world of Seinfeld, the real characters came to meet these other characters. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. The point to all this, which is what we're going to be circumambulating and we're going to be landing as we go into this more tonight and tomorrow, is that there is an essence, there is a core, there is an ontology to characters and to experience. Now, there was a wonderful line. I was resting today, and I came across this great line, which really captures so much of what I'm talking about and talking against in some ways. And it says, we bend the universe to our will, but only so far. It's interesting. We bend the universe to our will, but only so far. And in many of the myths, we find that we have to work with nature. We have to develop technology. We get the bulldozers, or we go out and we get bigger nets to fish and more sophisticated fishing techniques and all these things we do. But you realize ultimately the human has to succumb to nature. And the hubris of the human condition is that human supplants nature by our will. This is the theological and the spiritual premise upon which this work is about. That the shadow of any attempt to corrupt, interpret, misinterpret an image, or to contort it to our own will and desires is going to fall short. And it's bound to take us into some really troubled waters. Whereas the brilliance of Jung was that he saw the image and he said, okay, what do we know about the image of the king or the image of the hero? What do we know about the image of the trickster? And what von Franz would do, in the genius of von Franz, is she would then look at fairy tales. Say a cat, you dream of a cat doing such and such, a cat perched on a windowsill. And she would look and she had this encyclopedic mind and say, well, in the Chinese culture, in the Persian culture, in the Japanese culture, in the different parts of the world, here's what cat symbolized. Now, this is not meant to say this is to be academic and intellectual. This is not meant to say it's a rigid approach to imagery. But it's saying that there are some features to images that are core, that there's an essence. I mean, if you look at the way the indigenous people from here and in Africa and all over the world, the way they understood the world was the world was something to participate in, to try to understand something about the world. It wasn't about trying to overtake it. And when they would do the dances, I remember there'd be some of the dances, they'd be the antelope dance or the whatever dance, they tried to capture the essence of that animal. When they would dance and put the horns on and they would jump and hoot and make the sounds, they literally entered the world of that image or that animal to understand it. They didn't, as opposed to trying to just have their own fantasies, what I think an antelope's about. And I remember many, and going back 25, 30 years now, I was really taken by the totem poles from up here, the Pacific Northwest, where certain cultures would have the raven, or would have the whale, or would have the black bear, the grizzly bear, or further north, the polar bear, as images. And this culture was based on the dominant features of that animal. And they understood it was through something about the essence of this animal that represented their experience of God and the self. And it wasn't the fantasy of the animal. What we've done with images and with the world by and large is we have taken the will and consciousness, and we begin to morph and mutate everything to fit our needs. Now, everyone has heroes. One hero for me is Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel, some of you know his work. Concentration camp survivor. He's got the Nobel Prize for his work in liberation, helping people all over the world. And one of the many things he said is absolutely brilliant. He said, with the advent of the rational mind came the capacity to rationalize anything and everything. Now, of course, he's talking about the Holocaust. And we can make sense. Of course, we did it because of. And we do this all the time. Jung's psychology is a beautiful antidote to an anti-spiritual approach to life. And I'm not trying to pump up spirit and God. That's not the point. But there's something about the natural world that is a teacher for us. And you begin to find when one develops a coherent relationship to it, something about the world and the treasures begin to open up to us. Whereas the opposite side is when we begin to constantly project onto the natural world just our own needs and proclivities and fantasies, something starts closing down. And you find all the great mystics from the beginning of time, they sought to understand something about the nature of the world. And they were receptive. They listened. They shut up. They listened to people. They listened to dreams. They said, if a dream's coming this far, it's got to be the voice of God telling us something. Why don't we listen? Instead of just creating our own illusions and our own secular religions about this. Now, I've also been seeped in the new sciences the past 25 years, and I'm very happy to say I've had the chance and the honor to work with a lot of the world's greatest scientists, from systems theory, nuclear medicine, and all of these people have a humility. And I can say across the board, because we've been in Italy together now for 20-something years, and we sit together, have wine together. I have not seen a power drive. I have not seen the competition. There's something that they want to understand about the world, how things work, how things operate, these self-organizing principles. And the new sciences are really an attempt to understand the self-organization of the world and the innate properties of the natural world and psyche. It's a perfect complement to our work as Jungians here. So for a long time, I've been working really hard to try to understand something about the nature of imagery. And I had the good fortune back in, I began my analytic training in 1979 at the Jung Institute. And I had the good fortune to work with a man named Yoram Kaufman. We have one of his books here, The Way of the Image. He was a Israeli. He studied as a physicist in Israel. Then he came to the States and became a psychologist and later a psychoanalyst. And I remember when I was brought into his class, I suddenly saw a vision of psyche that was like nothing I've ever seen before in my life. Somebody that really took the image seriously. And he let the image guide his interpretations. He let the image guide what he would do with patients and guide his own life. And this was not a leaf in the wind kind of person. If you know Israelis, they're very tough people. Very tough, defiant people. Good people, strong people. But they're not going to just be yielding, right? But I saw the respect he gave to the image. And he would always ask a question, what do we know about the image itself? I mean, usually what we do is, oh, well, what do you think about? What do you think about the cat, huh? What do you think about the cat? So for you it means this and that, and whether we use street terms to describe things from the cat, or we say, I had a cat, and to me it's very sad because the cat died at a really young age, or to me it was all about punishment because the cat would claw and my parents were angry, or it's all about wonderful things. And we go on and on and on, on with these thoughts and these fantasies and these feelings. Now, we have to have our feelings. Part of the human condition is we are reactive and we learn and we're inquisitive. Another part of the human condition is we're terrified. Let's put both pieces on the table right now. We're also terrified. We're terrified of those things that knock in the night and that make those sounds. We don't know what they are. And what we do is we figure out what they are right away. Middle of the night, you get scared, you hear something, it's probably just the heat, right? It's just the heat in the pipes. The kids get sick and they start doing things. It's really nothing. But in the back of your mind, you wonder, could it really be? Could this be something I'm not aware of? And we cauterize ourselves time and time again. The ancients and the mystics didn't seem to do this so much because they lived in a world where there was more interconnection with nature and psyche, animism. And in some ways, this is a call for a return to an animistic way of life. Animistic, anima in Italian. I know you speak Italian, and maybe the same in Spanish. It means soul. It's the world is powered by the soul. The world is an expression of soul. So what you do is you look around the world and say, what part of soul do I see when I look at the cat? What part of soul do I see when I look at the German, the Israeli, the Italian, the French, or the Hungarian? What am I seeing? When I look at a cat, and I look at a dog, I look at a polar bear, I look at a black bear. These are parts of psyche that are telling us something, that are expressing part of the world of the objective psyche. This was the domain Jung was poking around in for many years. One of the other things that Dr. Kaufman did, which was just monumental, and you know, I was 26 years old when I began my training. I was 19 when I went to Zurich. I was far too young. Obviously, there was a destiny piece moving me. And they said, go home, you're too young. That was my reception in Zurich. Here I am. I feel like this hero going to Switzerland. I'm 19. They said, go home, you're too young. Go take a Jung tour. Take the Jung bus. But I didn't know there was no bus to do this. So anyway, one of the other things that Kaufman said was, interpretation. Now, we all do interpretation, right? All of us, whether you're a layperson, whether you're an analyst, whether you're a physician, whatever, we interpret. Well, that dream, if the cat did this, that's probably about your complex of X or Y. Or that may be because the other night you and your wife had such and such and happened. It's probably about that. Interpretation is highly speculative and is about conjecture. There's a real lack of precision and specificity in interpretation. Now, for only God knows the real reason, I've really been studying a lot about the Jewish traditions. Here's a good Italian Catholic boy from Brooklyn studying this stuff. And I introduced, some of you know the work of Rabbi Zalman, one of the leading rabbis. I introduced him in a conference we had. I said, why is this Italian American from Brooklyn introducing this famous rabbi? I said, I don't know. You know, like that line of Fiddler on the Roof, I don't know. So anyway, there was a beautiful piece by one of the foremost Talmudic scholars. And his name is Saul Lieberman. And he writes that when he approaches Talmudic text and you see these beautiful traditions, he said, I try to be as free of conjecture and bias as possible to understand the text on its own terms. Because when I have my own biases and my own fantasies and my own thoughts about it, I'm going to suddenly say, well, this must be about X or Y. He said, let the text reveal itself. Now, if you just hold that, this is a profound understanding and is a radical departure from what we're doing with dreams today. Similarly put, Jung said, what we usually do with dreams and images is we make meaning of images. Now, I bet everybody, we should shake our heads, right? Well, we make meaning of images. And he's hooking the fish with that one. Okay, we're going to make meaning of images. You have a dream? So let's make meaning of that. He said, you don't have to do it, though. Let the meaning reveal itself to you. Let the inherent, innate meaning reveal itself. This is a whole different methodology. This is where Jung was and where Jungian psychology is moving away from today. And I'll explain why as I go on with this. This is why when Jung began to look at dreams and images from his patients and fantasies, he went back and said, like, remember the very famous one where there was a sock or a tube coming off the sun? A patient says, you see, Dr. Jung, there's this thing, this like sock coming down from this, and do you see it? If you just shake your head and you watch it, you see it. He said, well, this is a sick patient. He said, this person, no wonder why they're in the back wards. They're really sick. And anyway, he finally said, well, wait a minute. Could there be something to that fantasy that is objective? Could that fantasy have been part of the world of humanity at some point in time? Do you realize how profound that question is right there? And what he did, he began his studies and he found, my God, there was these ancient alchemical texts that literally talked about the very image. And it actually said, if you shake your head and you hold your finger up to this, you begin to see this. And it's an expression of the Virgin Mary, of the Great Mother. He said, how does patient know it? This was the beginning of Jung's work with the objective psyche and the world of the archetypes. And he said, in the same way there are these morphological constants in the human body, there are these inherited archetypal features or constants in the human psyche. How do they get there? You tell me, how did the gallbladder get in your body? You know, it's the same thing. These are inherited potentialities. And he began to see that more and more when he had this realization that these were not just personal constructions. Another word to highlight as we go on. These were not just personal constructions of fantasies of the dreamer, but they represented an unfolding of some a priori aspect of human nature. He said, my God, there's a whole other strata to the human psyche that we haven't talked about for 50, 60, 70 years. Again, the ancients did. Read Black Elk Speaks, the dream that Black Elk has, and then the wise men come and say, well, let's talk about what that dream means. That dream is a telling of the great fathers or the great mothers. In all the ancient traditions, they looked at the dream as a way that the gods came down to earth to tell us an important message. And they said, you got to know that message. Not the message you want it to be, not the message you want to write in a bottle, but what message is contained. So Kaufman said, you know what, let's move away from interpretation. No, I didn't understand what he meant, but I said, that's ridiculous. I'm a psychoanalyst. We're analysts and we're therapists and we all interpret. He said, you don't know. When you allow the image to reveal itself, we're working with a very different modality. In many ways, we're working like human ethologists, if you know the term. Not ethnology, ethologists, which is a study of natural patterns. So what you begin to look at with the image is you say, what's been known about this image? Now, in no way is this meant to discredit, marginalize, make light of the individual's reaction to the image. Now, by way of a story, now we take the next step. We have a little bit of the scaffolding here. For years, I struggled with, you know what gout is? Gout is a terrible inflammatory problem, and to talk about inflammatory things in Italian is kind of ridiculous anyway, because everything Italians do is inflammatory. Everything is explosive and so anyway, I struggled for years with this. And you wake up, you know what it's like, you wake up in the morning and all of a sudden your ankle is just blown out like three or four times the size and you can't walk and you're literally crawling for 2 days or you're on crutches or a cane for 3 days. Now, yeah, I'd be out playing basketball the night before taking a run and all of a sudden I have this thing happen. So I went to the doctors. After a while, stubborn. I went to the doctor. He said, well, you probably got a broken bone. Let's take a couple $1,000 worth of x-rays. Okay, fine. We'll do it. X-rays and all this stuff. And guess what? Nothing worked. So for seven years, I struggled with this thing. Every couple of months, it would start. And you get afraid. Oh, when's it going to happen next, right? When's it going to happen next? So finally, one day, he wasn't there. And the nurse practitioner was there. And I said, I come in, I was ashen. I looked like hell, you know. And she said, what is wrong with you? I said, I can't walk. My feet are just swollen like five times. Literally, you can't wear a shoe. You can't even put sneakers on. It's that bad. And you can't put a feather to your foot when it happens or to your joints. Can we get that door, please? So anyway, she said, you probably have gout. I said, what's gout? Well, what's gout? And she said, well, here's what I'm going to do. I want you to go to the hospital, get a blood test, and see. It's high levels of uric acid in the system. And if it is gout, we'll figure out why you're getting it and all that kind of stuff, diet. And also, I'm going to give you a prescription, indomethacin, right? You take the medicine, and if it's what I think it is, go home, go to sleep for 3 hours in the pain you're in right now. And if this is the right diagnosis, you're going to wake up in 3 hours and feel like it's a beautiful day, and you go out for a run. I said, right, from your lips to ears of God. Well, guess what happened? I do it. I go to bed and say, right, here's going to be another hell of a long day. I wake up 3 hours later. I think the sun came out. And I said, wow, this is like a miracle. And I start singing miracle songs, Anyway, so I was giving a lecture recently, and I told the story. So for how many years? So for 5-7 years, my doctor didn't catch it. The nurse practitioner caught it. Anyway, this person, a very, very well-known analyst, asked question. And this is a person that trains analysts around the world. I mean, literally all over the world. And he says, look, I got to ask you something. He said, I really love what you're saying about the objective psyche and how you work with images and all that. He said, but there's a story about a very famous analyst he went up to tell me, named Heinz Kohut. Some of you know Heinz Kohut's work. He said, Heinz Kohut was asked once if many different analysts could work on a dream and not really understand what the dream meant, but they can make some interpretation, the patient will get better. Get the picture? So even if you don't know what the dream is, you say, well, I think it's about green or about blue or about your mother, your father. Okay, and the patient gets better. So he said, do you think empathy, and this is the answer Kohut gave, he said, empathy is what would make the interpretation accurate. I said, in all due respect, this is why I told my gout story. I said, in all due respect, my physician really cares about me, has a lot of empathy for me and for my family. He missed my gout for 7 years. He didn't understand it. He missed it. It's the same thing with images. That you begin to see in the same way that a really good artist understands the mixing of colors. A really good musician knows the difference between certain chordal progressions, or you add a seventh and a ninth, you add a diminished this, that you know that if you want a certain sound, you make a certain chord, so you do it. Or a really good writer, they know that if you just word crafter, wordsmithed a little bit, you turn a whole sentence around, you turn a whole paragraph around by one or two little words. There's an art. There's an artistry to working with images. And when you begin to realize, or if you can consider, that an image lives is a expression of the field that it's embedded in, and that the field has some constant characteristics to it, it totally shifts your working with dreams. Your question then is not so much, what do you want to do with the image, where do you go with it, but what does nature know about this image? What has humanity known about this image? I mean, one very simple one is begin to kind of whet your appetite with what I'm saying here. Say somebody has a dream of a cat, of a kitty cat. And in the dream, they say to the cat, oh, go roll over, honey. Go, here's a ball. Hey, go fetch. Go catch the ball. Go get the piece of wood, whatever, and go fetch it, bring it back. Okay, sit, roll over. Okay. And they say, isn't this a great dream? And my cat's rolling over and playing and all that. Well, maybe it's just me. Most cats don't do this. I look at the cat. My cat just passed away the other day, actually. But you say to the cat, well, go roll over. And the cat says, like Robert De Niro, you're talking to me. You want me to roll over? I don't think so. Go talk to the dog over there. Go talk to the dog. D-O-G. Go talk to the dog and ask the dog to roll over, because I'm not going to do it. I'm too independent for that. Now, that's a huge dream. You say, but I love the cat, and I like playing with the cat, and these are my fantasies about the cat. That's the point. We can fantasize as much as we want, but if we don't capture the essence of something, we're insulting the image. And something that dawned on me recently, it kind of came home to me in spades, is one of the greatest gifts in life is when you see somebody for who they really are. With the wrinkles, with the hair or lack of, with their characteristics, with the potential, high ceiling, low ceiling. But you say, you know what? You see them for the truth of who they are. What a gift. And I think one of the greatest assaults is when we see somebody and we project onto them our fantasies. Like, believe it or not, some people think I'm from Vermont. When I talk, I say, I don't think I'm from Vermont. I don't know why you get that impression. I'm not from Vermont. It's kind of clear. Subtle. But it's so powerful, because if you take the time to know something or somebody, it means you're getting out of your own way. Jung said, it's okay, come on. I'm sorry. Is there any water or anything, please? A glass of water or something? Oh, thank you so much. And what a gift. I mean, how much of our lives are spent with projection? And this is where Jung went with imagery, okay? He said, look, you know, when we could spend all this time imagining and subjectifying and making relative meaning of things. He said, let's really shift the paradigm. Now we're going to shift the paradigm. He said, the shifting of the paradigm is saying there is, in fact, something objective about an image. Now, a question is, something I had to ask about 3 or 4 years ago, is if that's the case, if there is something inherent about an image, why do we spend so much time saying, well, what do you think and what do you feel about it, if they are really quite different from the ontological? And I realize all of the associations we have, especially when they're different from the core of the image, it reveals how we are aligned to that image. The alignment reveals so much about where the individual is at. It's like if you got a key, you got a beautiful room over here, and your key doesn't fit, what's going to happen? You're not going to get in that room. You have a key to that room, you suddenly can see what's in it. It's the same thing with imagery. So one of the ways of doing this is to look at the world of patterning. Now we're taking the next step. Patterns. A pattern is a coalescing of information into recognizable form. I'll say it again, then I'll translate. A pattern is a coalescing of multiple trajectories, a coalescing of information into a recognizable form. Okay? You get up every day, there's certain things you do. You get up, you have your coffee, or you meditate, or you take a run. You go back to bed with your coffee, you read a book. This is your characteristic things that you do. Every culture has certain patterns. This is not about stereotyping. or profiling, but there are certain patterns people have to life, okay? Well, there's something called coherence in patterns. Coherence is when a pattern expresses itself in its own characteristic way. And you begin to find that the pattern is not an independent entity, but the pattern is an expression of a field. Okay? New York, for one simple example. Thank you. Boy, ask Kalamad. I want fried squid later. How about that? There are certain things New Yorkers do, the way they act, the way they do business. And I remember when I moved to Vermont, I would go to the copy shop and say, you know what, can I get a couple of these copies made tomorrow? Well, by God, you know, feel kind of rushed about that one. We got maple and sugar in the dough. We got lagen. We got deer season coming up. I say, I only want 100 copies. Can you get 100 copies? Wow. You must be from New York. You're a real pushy one. Mabel, come on out here. He's a real pushy one. One of these New Yorkers, flatland pushy guys. I say, okay, can I still get 100 copies? I don't know. And, you know, so I tried to make believe I was one of them. So I come in and I say, look, I hate to rush you. In the next 6 months, if you can get like 50 copies, I hate to really even ask this of you, but maybe one copy a day, and that would be great, if that's not too much, and I don't want to mess up your venison and your deer and your everything. They still know us in the city, somehow. So anyway, things are highly patterned. And, you know, one of the ways we know the world is by the patterns around us and within us. Every animal survives by virtue of the ability to do pattern recognition. Right now in Vermont, you know, we're in early fall, and, you know, the deer are getting a different coat. It's a much darker coat, a heavier coat. The nut gatherers are gathering their nuts. Okay. Yeah, we knew it was you. Yeah, the nut gatherers gathering there. You see a lot of squirrels and the chipmunks. You know, they're recognizing. They know that there's a change. The fish that were out are not where they used to be. So everything responds to the cycles of nature. So whether you're a fisherman, you're a hunter, you're a gardener, a parent. I mean, how do we know what our kids are going through? My boy just went off to college, you know, and for the past 2 years, he was more and more ready from getting his driver's permit, getting the driver's license, girlfriends, all that goes with having a girlfriend, you know. And you begin to read the patterns. And if you don't read the patterns, we're going to have some trouble. This is a pattern of independence. This is a pattern of a parent holding on a little too tight sometimes, a little too tight to the reins. And knowing what happens when somebody's 19. What happens at 19 is very different from 13 and 14, you know? So all of this, all of the child developmental theory is about what? It's about reading pattern behavior. All of medicine, all of art is about patterns, if you think about it. I was telling you, you have a wonderful Picasso exhibit here in town. I wish I was here long enough to see it. It's reading patterns. I mean, who was it? Dali, right? That he would do the essence of an image. He would start with like an elephant or a horse, and by the end of it, he had just like one or two lines capturing it. He was trying to capture what? The essence of something. And you knew, you didn't need the reins or the nose and all this. You knew he was still getting at the essence of a horse. So what we do is we're natural pattern readers, and we look at patterns all the time, and we're dealing with patterns all the time. Pattern behavior. Pattern in our relationships. How many people have gone through the same kind of relationship 10 times over, 6 times over? Nobody here, though, I know. None of us. We're all immune to that. We don't do that. But how often you say, hey, oh, my God, what is this, like deja vu? Well, I'm back to the same thing, the same issue. It's their fault, though. See, I don't know why they brought out the worst of me, but they brought it out and we're back down the same thing. It wasn't me. You know, the beauty of this work is finding out that nature reveals its secrets every second to us by way of the expression of these patterns. The dark side of this is that we get so taken over by patterns, and sometimes we don't break them. I mean, I have a new book coming out, And it's all about complex. I talked a little bit about a couple of years ago when I see a complex in possession, but about how we're taken over by things and we live out a pattern time and time and time and time again. So now when we look at this world of patterns and we introduce the word coherence to it, which is, again, what my work is about as a film consultant, you look at the natural unfolding of a pattern. There's a sequence. The natural world reveals us every day. Just look at your trees and the colors right now. Look at the fish that's coming in on the markets that maybe what compared to what was coming in on the market a month ago. We begin to read it. So if you suddenly find that, let's say the salmon run, when's the salmon run? When do you get bow salmon? What time of year? In the markets?
Early fall.
Okay, early fall. So let's say suddenly you find midwinter all these salmon coming in. You have to say one thing. What's going on? Well, at least that's different. That's what I'm getting at with patterns. Marie-Louise von Franz made a beautiful comment. She said, archetypes are nature's constants. Archetypes are nature's constants, which means the archetype reveals the natural way or the natural cycles of life. So again, if you've got a big salmon run in the middle of winter, you got to say, this doesn't seem to fit up. I'm not saying right or wrong. Right now I'm not saying that. The other expression she gave us is contra naturum. Contra naturum, which is contrary to nature. So like when you say to the little kitty cat, roll over, Topsy, go fetch. It's not so much the nature of a cat to want it. I mean, some cats will do that, yes. But the majority, 90% of cats are not going to play that out. It's your fantasy. It's your projection, your illusion. So when Jung said, we don't need to make meaning of images, let the image reveal itself, he's giving us a tremendous discipline, which means get into the skin of the image. What's that mean? It means that if you have an image, and I'll give you another example that I wrote about in the book, Feel, Form, and Fate. A patient of mine many years ago dreamt of a lungfish, L-U-N-G. I said, what's a lungfish? He said, I have no idea. I said, well, neither do I. He never heard of a lungfish. And I never heard of a lungfish. And, you know, and of course we should do what everyone should do. Well, what do you think about lungfish? Well, I think lungs, I think of smoking. I think of aerobics, anaerobics. I think of fresh air, bad air. You know, all the things anybody would say. It was flat as a pancake, this whole session. And I said, you know what, I'm going to tell you right now, we really can't do any work on the stream today. Now, this is more than a whistle stop in our journey here, okay? Can you understand, at least where I'm coming from, why I would say we really can't work in that dream? We can understand what you would imagine a lungfish is. You said, well, you know what? I do smoke too much, or I smoke too much weed, or you know what? I don't do enough aerobic, whatever it is, the anaerobic, whatever it is. I don't do enough exercise. I should be running more. I should be doing some calisthenics. I should be, you know, getting the oxygen moving to my system, get my lungs moving. Or you know what? I had an uncle that worked in the asbestos mines, bad lungs, or black lung disease. We can have all these thoughts. Let's shift the paradigm dramatically. So when we say that we really can't work with that image to understand its nature because of what? Because we don't know anything about it. All we know are your subjective renderings of that image. Now, again, most of us would stop with that and say, wow, black lung, the West Virginia miners. Let's talk about that. Or, you know, where I'm from in Brooklyn, a lot of the old timers worked on the boats and they got asbestos in their lungs. You know, cousin Sal, you know what you got? He got $200,000 from the insurance company because he got the lung, he got the asbestos. I got nothing. Yeah, well, Uncle said, I got nothing. He couldn't find me. I had to make it up. So they make up these crazy stories. But the point is, then you could talk about families and insurance benefits or the limitation of your life because you got asbestos in your lungs. Or the exploitation, right? They exploited you. They exploited the workers. They didn't give you any protection. They should have at least big masks on you. So you're living in a world where there's no protection. Right, got it. That's our lungfish. Now remember, you see how I got there? You got it? You're laughing. This is what we do with dreams. The Freudian approach to dreams, look, Freud was brilliant in his own right. And I'm totally against all the Freud bashing. He held the torch just so long. And then it took somebody else to pick it up. But what he did with dreams is He basically saw the dream, and this is fundamental our understanding of where we're going. He saw the dream image as a springboard to go somewhere. Just like on a diving board, you dive and you get more momentum and you go further out. He said the image is meant to just provoke you to see where you would go with the associations. Now remember, our tradition is with free association, you begin with the lungfish, you go to the black lungs in West Virginia, you go to Uncle Sal who had asbestos in the lungs, and who got $100,000 of insurance company, and you got, I got nothing, so the world's unfair. You know, oh, then you go lungs, I think of, oh, I remember that, I want to do a marathon. I want to do a marathon someday. I'm making a song, okay? So anyway, the point is, the image was seen, and here's the key point to this, the image was seen as an empty vessel. The image is empty. It's only there to spur you on to something. And wherever the ball lands, you know, like in the roulette thing, wherever the ball lands is where it's got to land. So if we end up with the dream of the lungfish and we end up with, why don't you try that marathon? I think it'd be a good thing for you to do, you know, try the marathon. It's pushing yourself and you don't push it, you know, whatever. That's what Freud did with dreams. And that was our prevailing paradigm for 50, 60 years. But again, remember, understand, the image was seen as simply a vessel to be filled by the individual and to take you somewhere. And where it took you didn't matter. Because in his mind, it was related. And Jung came on, and Jung was diametrically opposed to this. And for my money, and I think for many of us, I think Jung is more accurate with it. He said, wait a minute. If you dream of asbestos, if you dream of lungfish, there must be something psyche's trying to tell you. If it's being that specific, why don't we take the time to see what God is giving you if it's giving you a lungfish? Shh. Be quiet for a minute. Shut up for a minute. Quiet. You know, John Kabat-Zinn and a lot of the meditators, they talk about quiet the mind. Quieting the mind means allowing the psyche to speak. When we do all of this fancy footwork and the cha-cha moves and all of this stuff we do to do these associations, it really is in defense and defiance of the objective psyche. When you then ask the million-dollar question, now can somebody tell me with the dream of the lungfish, what's the million-dollar question? Ah, you're going too deep already. What's a lungfish? Is there a lungfish? I didn't know if there was a lungfish. Well, it just so happened, and so I told the patient, we'll come back this next week, let's both go do some work on it. Now, again, I'm not trying to say this is about intellectual exercise, but again, if an image is coming to you, the image is filled with some meaning. If I say to you, dopo questo congresso devi ritornare a casa mia. Now, if you don't understand me, are you going to say that I didn't say anything to you? You don't understand that language. Or if you speak to me in French or something, I don't understand you. What arrogance and hubris to say, let me just imagine. So what you said was, I want to go out, I want to get calamari after the lecture tonight. Well, that's great. That's not what I said. I said, after my lectures tomorrow, I'm going to have a lovely dinner, then I'm going to go home to my family in Vermont. You understood it, right?
Well, a casa mia at my house.
A casa mia. But you see the point I'm making? That's where Kaufman then went with translation. If we interpret, you say, you're going out for calamari, you're talking about going out, get a drink later, you're going out dancing. That's what I think you said. Why did you take the time to find out what I said? Why don't I take the time to figure out why do you behave the way you do? There must be something about it. If I interpret, I'm going to speculate. Well, this is because your mother, father, sister, brother passed and all that kind of stuff. Often you find there's a forward-moving dimension to behavior and images. So when you translate, we get into the spirit of the image itself, diametrically opposed to almost every approach. This is Jung's original work, okay? This is nothing new. So I was at a lecture a number of years ago. Somebody said, hey, he's famous as Conforti. He's not doing anything different from Jung and von Franz. I said, thank you. If you're going to put me in that circle, thank you. But 90% of the work on dreams today is this follow the bouncing ball, jumping off the springboard and see where we land, from the lungfish to Uncle Sal to the insurance case to the marathon. You guys want to come in? Is that okay for them to come in?
Yeah.
He'll be here for the refreshments later. They heard they got getting good food later. So with the lungfish, what I had to do is I had to say, let's go do our work and find out about lungfish. Again, if Psyche came this far to give it this specific image, let's find out if there's such a thing. But what I did was something you may think is kind of wacky, but I called the Boston Aquarium. And I called and I said, look, you know, this sounds strange. My name's Dr. Conforti. I'm a psychoanalyst. And I figured that was enough to turn him against me. And I said, look, I got a request. I had a patient in a dream of a lungfish. This is before the internet and Google and all that stuff. So I'm going back 15, 20 years. I'm dating myself, right? Yeah. So we didn't have those opportunities back then, okay? And I said, could you tell me anything about a lungfish? And he said, just so happens, and I'm going to give you a couple of synchronicities tonight and tomorrow. Just so happens we have a lungfish exhibit. God's honest truth. I said, okay. And he was wonderful. He gave me like a half hour tutorial on lungfish. And he said, well, lungfish are close to extinct, but they're making a little bit of a comeback. But does anybody know the big issue with lungfish? The thing that makes them unique? Now, let's go slow. You can say there are many things about lungfish. So we're understanding right now, we're moving beyond just the association, Uncle Sal, insurance, and marathon. Okay, that's on one side. Now we're getting to the ontological, to the essence of an image. Now, one question is going to be is, can there really be one essence to something? Bear with me. He said, the thing that is most unique about the lungfish, and it's one of the only fish in the world that can do this, is that in times of drought, they burrow into the mud, and they can live there for months at a time. So that means they got to breathe. So maybe it's not purely fish. What'd you call it then? Amphibian. Huh? Amphibian, maybe? I don't know. But he said it's one of the only species in the world that has the capacity to do this. So times of tremendous, for a fish, this is pretty rugged stuff, no water, you know. So at times of unimaginable adversity, that fish found a way to survive, and it's done this through the centuries. Thus the lung fish can breathe. Okay. The patient knew nothing, I knew nothing about it. I have this wonderful good fortune of a synchronicity to tell me this information. Well, how does that help us? Tremendously. I had never in my career seen this image in a patient before or since. Ask yourself a question. We're not going to do group stuff right now, but just ask yourself a question. If you're sitting with someone, whether it was your child, other loved one, the patient, whatever, if they had that dream, and now you found out the central thing about a lungfish is the capacity to burrow into the mud and survive tremendous adversity, ask yourself a question. I wonder why Psyche gave this particular image to this particular patient. Let's even stop right there. We don't even need to do go around right now. But you know what I'm saying? Ask the question. Psyche's not random. This is not some crapshoot where you, come on, let's see what comes, lucky seven, whatever. There's a beautiful specificity. And this is what a lot of my book, Field, Form, and Fate, is about. It's this hand-in-glove fit between psyche and matter, between matter and spirit, where one becomes an expression of the other. And these images is as though tailor-made, just to fit your psyche, just like our body. You ever get? I want to get a suit someday that's specially made for men. I haven't done it yet. Someday I may do it. Imagine what it must be like, a shirt that fits just your body. This image came to describe some piece of the essence of this dreamer that neither of us were aware about. What did it say? It said, despite anything I thought about the prognosis of this case, where was it going to go, whatever. What's it saying? This patient has the unimaginable ability to withstand and survive tremendous adversity. This dream is a wake-up call to the patient, to the analyst, to whomever, to say, despite what's going on in the patient's life, say, my things look terrible. I don't know if you're ever going to make it. Can you ever get out of this problem or whatever? This dream is saying, this patient, in all likelihood, they're going to make it based on that image. It's one of the only images in the world, in the universe, that could do this. come on, you really got to take image that seriously? Isn't that your fantasy? Is this my fantasy, or am I just trying to articulate what nature has given us? This is the difference. So you're saying it's about the patient? No. When you translate, what you're doing is you're looking at the core or the essence of a phenomena, and you're saying what it is. And this is, we have our own training program in Vermont, in archetypal pattern analysis. We do a whole training program in dream patterning where we practice. You know, we do an image of a refrigerator or of a stove or of a muffler in a car or a carburetor. Or one great one is, one image we worked on is a derailleur on a bicycle. Say somebody dreams of a derailleur. You know, everybody know what a derailleur is? Okay, a derailleur is on the bikes that have different gears. The derailleur is the mechanism on the back wheel that shifts the chain over to higher, lower. Yeah. So let's say somebody has a dream of a derailleur. Now, again, the first thing that's going to happen in most of our approaches is we say, tell me about a derailleur. Well, I felt derailleur the other night. I was going to go home and read. I had the extra two glasses of wine, and you know what? I got derailed, and I went to bed. Or I ended up going to sleep on the couch, and you know, it was a bad night. Derailleur, when I think of derailleur, I think of crazy. You know, when you get derailed, sometimes you really lose your track. I lost my orientation. And again, we go on and on and on. You see what I'm getting at? With the associations, this is where 95% of our therapies go, our dream work. The question now is what? In the same way with the lungfish, what's your question if somebody's going to have a dream of a derailleur? Huh? What's a derailleur? What's a derailleur? Now, if anybody knows, I used to do it years ago, and I knew a fair amount about derailleurs. A derailleur allows you to navigate in different types of terrain. You're going up a hill, and you need a certain gearing to go up a hill. Easier to go up. You go down a hill, you need a harder gear, so you have more, you know, a lot more to crank with. If you're on a flat, you need a certain gear. What it's talking about now, you see, now here's where translation comes in, which is so beautiful. You see, the translation, as opposed to interpretation is all about your speculation. When you translate, you're getting into the ontological core of the image and say, okay, look, first thing we need to do when you translate is we need to understand the image in its own context. Tell me about bicycles and derailleurs, or where the term came from originally. Okay?
Well, you're also sort of talking about thinking subjective and objective.
Right.
Because projecting and interpreting is all subjective. There's a lot of your headspace.
Beautiful, exactly. Beautiful. And that's why you say, okay, look, that's all the interpretation. And we can get back to a biking race, or you did biking racing years ago, right? And we could talk about that. We could talk about many things. Or that wonderful movie we saw where the couple was riding a bike and they stopped, and it was in France, right? Right? They're in France. They had the big straw basket on the bike. They had a bottle of wine, and they stop, and they pull out the blanket. And out of the basket, they pull the bread. They get the bread. They get the beautiful cheese. They pull out a bouquet of flowers. They got a ham, a big 5-pound ham they pull out. You know, and then of course, no one was around, and they made love. Oh, my God, right? What a beautiful thing. That's about a bike in Derailleur. That's wishful thinking, maybe, or whatever. But if you stay with the derailleur, and then we say we understand now a derailleur in its own context. A derailleur helps us to navigate different terrains. It helps to facilitate a more difficult upward climb because it gives it easier pedaling. And it helps us when we're on the downs and the flats. This is a parable. This is the stuff I love about this work because it's a parable and says one needs to know in life how to navigate different terrains, different psychological terrains. There are times when we are doing an uphill climb and it's rough. We've all been there. Whether it's making a living, supporting a family, maybe you have a real challenging situation at home with your kids or whatever, or you work on a really exciting project and it's a lot of work, you know. I mean, we've all been there. We have a big project. Maybe you're looking for a grant, or you're writing a book, or you're building a wonderful relationship or a marriage. There's work there. and sometimes say, this is kind of uphill. That's not bad. It's a part of life. And then there are parts of life when, you know what, you can cruise. Right now, you say, you know what, you're in a good phase. And you're not having to kill yourself right now. You're riding on the flats. You need to know how to pace yourself if you're going to be on the flats. This is the stuff of the mystics taught us about. This is the stuff that where we begin to see that psyche and the mystics and psyche, the objective image, and the eternal wisdom traditions, they all have a confluence. And the waters come together. It requires a humility from us. It requires a quieting of the mind to be able to do this work. Now, I want to read a little piece from that to help us understand this tendency to have to make meaning all the time. It's a wonderful little book called The Sabbath by Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he writes, our imagination tends to mold all concepts in its image. In our daily life, we attend primarily to that which the senses are spelling out for us, to what the eyes perceive, to what the figures and the fingers touch. Reality to us is a thinghood consisting of substances that occupy space. Even God is conceived by most of us as a thing. The result of all our thingness is our blindness to all reality that fails to identify itself as a thing, as a matter of fact. And he goes on to say that what we really need to do instead is to approach the ineffable, approach the mysteries, because the mysteries are there trying to teach us something. And the mysteries can be apprehended if we take the time to understand their language. In the same way, when I talk to you in Italian a minute, take the time to understand the language. This is where Jung was at his best. This is where the Jungian tradition gives us a gift beyond imagination, when you could begin to see the seeds of a destiny in an image. When you look at a child, even a three-year-old and five-year-old little kid, you begin to see an intimation of a future, intimation of certain tendencies. I mean, my boy, when he was a little kid, he would sit by the register, you know, the heat register on the floor, and say there were curtains right by the window, right? And he would just watch. I thought he was autistic at first. I said, my God, well, my kid's just sitting there watching the billowing of the thing. And his mom says to me, no, he's just watching the shapes that the air makes as it goes into the curtains. To this day, my son is fascinated by patterns, and I dedicate a lot of this work to him, as I do in the book. He made me aware of patterns. You take a bite of a piece of bread, he said, Dad, that looks like a half moon, that looks like this, that looks like that. And you begin to see that kids understand this stuff. They read patterns in life. We stop because we get afraid, and also because we don't seem to have the tools. And what I'm saying with this is, with the work of dream patterning, there are very specific tools that we need to develop. Now, let me give you one dream, which would be the major dream we work on for the evening, okay? Patient dreams the following. I'm not going to tell you anything about the dreamer, okay? Just a dream. I go to visit my friends. I go to their house, I visit my friends, and there are about five of them, four of them sitting around a table. And they're all playing cards. And, you know, they're dealing and playing cards and all this. And I just sit down because I want to talk and I have a little drink with them, whatever. And as I'm sitting there, they do a new round and they inadvertently deal me in. I'm dealt a royal flush. This is an incredible dream. Any card players? Yeah, you. Okay, tell me about a royal flush.
Best hand you can get.
Now, one of the ways that we teach this work is we say, is that speculation or fact? Is that speculation or fact, my man?
That's fact.
It's factual. There's no conjecture with that. There's no bias. It's a fact that if you're going to play cards, there are certain rules to the game, and that's the best hand you can get. Now, you be my card expert as we go on with the stream then, okay? So with the dream, again, we should do all of our, we should always ask, I think, for association and all of that stuff. Friends, who are they? What are they doing? Is it five, four around a table? Again, all very important stuff. Now, if you cut to the chase of the image, now remember, I'm talking about coherency in symbols, symbolic coherence, which means that, as a way to get to my point of symbolic coherence, you've got a nip in the air, late September, apples are turning red on the tree, deer are getting heavy coats. Read the pattern. Where are we? Fall. Okay, again, not rocket science, but you see what I'm getting at here is all the constituent parts are an expression of the pattern. And in many ways, what we're learning to do with this kind of work, it's a holographic perceptual model in that you're reading it like a hologram. You're seeing a part and you're inferring the whole from the part. So if I just said, late September, deer have a heavy coat, we're talking about fall in all likelihood. Now, what happens in fall and all that, there are many things that can happen in fall, many experiences you've had, but the fact is, what? There are certain things that do inevitably happen in fall. There are certain regularities to fall, certain regularities to summer. So you can begin to say that, you know what? We're in a phase of life. I mean, how many songs have been written about the seasons? Henry Mancini's September, Willie Nelson even sang it. And it's a beautiful song. They talk about what happens in May and June and July and August. And, you know, some of us, as we get older, you hit fall in life. And it's similar to what happens in fall. You know, you begin the harvest. And as those of us that hit our mid-50s and beyond, it's a time to start hopefully harvesting what we spend a lifetime developing in our work. So it matches up perfectly. So you begin to see that there are certain pieces that go to fall. So again, you could say, you know, you're reading one or two feet, you say, I think these are all part and parcel of the season of fall. It's the same thing with every image. You begin to realize that every image is capturing a field. So you look at sort of space and beyond, that you have an image, and the image is an explication of a field. And our interest is in the field that it's coming from, right? Like when I read cookbooks, I love to have cookbooks that tell a story about the food. Why this happened in this culture, why they did it that way, why the cream sauce there, why this there, or what, you know, whatever. I love the story because it tells you the matrix out of which stuff emerges. So what happens here is we have a card game. So we see people at a table. She's coming to visit. There are many parts to this. But what would you say the central piece that we need to focus on in the dream is? And again, because of time, it's the card game. Now, again, we could say many things about card games. And in my childhood, there was a lot about card games. This is not my dream. It's a patient. Actually, a woman had the dream a number of years ago. And there are a lot of wonderful things around the table. After you ate like 8 courses, you play cards, you bring the penny jars out. Everybody, they yell and they scream and they do that. And you know they're going to be sandwiches coming after 2 hours of cards at midnight. And, you know, it was fun. The family was together. So, again, we could all have our thoughts and reactions to it. But the issue is there anything that we can say objectively about a card game? Now, think about it. What are some of the expressions about cards that we hear in life? The card, those are the cards you were dealt, you know. It's fate. Card games have a lot to do with fate because you, no matter how good you are at cards, you still got to deal with the cards you were dealt. Is that a powerful image in and of itself right there? To me, this is profound. You got a pair of twos, you got a royal flush. Now, as we begin to take it the next step, okay, you play cards, right? So somebody got a pair of twos, and somebody has a pair of aces. The way I'm presenting it is, can you see where I'm going? That you need to learn how to play that pair of twos. You need to learn how to play the king of aces. Now we find out this is not even aces. This is the best hand you can ever play, you can ever get in your life. Remember I'm saying each image is an explication of a field. So that image is telling us a story. And the thing I love about the movies, working with movies, is a director or writer will use a scene to tell you something. Somebody walks up to somebody like this, and they walk away. They're telling you a story. Or somebody goes over here and they smile and they walk away. Or somebody looks over here and they put their eyes down and they reach in their pocket and they walk away. Each of these are a story. The director and writer is trying to convey something with tremendous meaning by that image, by that one little scene. And you begin to see Hitchcock was one of the best. If you ever get a chance, go back and watch some Hitchcock movies and read listen to the director cuts on it. Brilliant. How many people in the scene? What kind of flooring? Was it wood flooring? Was it tile? Was it this? How many people in lifeboat? Brilliant. So you begin to see that it's an expression. So by the way the actor is playing that scene, it's meant to convey a whole story to you by the image. The same thing by the image and the symbol. Okay? So now I'll ask, what's your name?
Dave.
Okay. The director, the writer, right? They say, Dave, you know what? We're going to give this guy over here, we're going to give Tom or Mary, we're going to do this, we're going to open the scene, a card game, right? And I'm going to give him the royal flush. And we're going to call 1-800-DAVE, a bureau card expert. And now, you know, now, in all seriousness, what do you think the writer is trying to convey by this very specific image?
That she's already pretty lucky. She's got it dealt to her all by herself.
And she got what?
She got it dealt. She got it dealt. She won.
Huh? But she didn't win yet.
No.
She didn't win yet.
She's a winner. It's that she, it's hers to lose. She was already given. She was given everything she needs.
Beautiful. Beautiful. You hear what he said? See, he didn't. Dave didn't say she won, because we don't know if she's going to win. But she was dealt something incredible. So if we put in very simple terms now, what is a major thing the writer is saying? Go real simple now. With everything you said, just summarize. Make a reduction out of it. This, we're trying to convey what by this scene?
She was given everything she needs.
Wow. She was given something about the best possible thing. Everything she needs, well, not quite, but she was given the best of something. She was given the best hand possible. Now, that, as we begin to understand about fate and destiny, we say, wow, this person was given one heck of a destiny. Now we go back to 1-800-DAVE and say, Dave, okay, let's say we hire you as a consultant. And that's what they do in the movie industry. They hire consultants for all these scenes. If we hired you, and you gave me 10% of everything you made, right? Because it's big money consulting. If we hired you, what is it you would have to tell? Say the director knew nothing about it. Say, oh, I heard it was a royal flush. That's great. What would have to be part of the scene? As they begin to, they got the cards, they got the royal flush, what has to then happen in that scene?
Her reaction has to set up whatever happens next.
Beautiful. Right, you're good at it. No, it's perfect. It's perfect. Because my point I'm getting at here is the image is not about random activities. The image is taking us into a preformed field. There is a preformed field of the fall. There's a preformed field of winter. And those of us that, you know, those of you in the room that are in your 70s and 80s and later, that's winter of life. My father says 94. So every day I wake up and above ground is a good day. You know? And you begin to find that people in the 80s and 90s, their lives are totally different from those of us that are in their 40s and 50s and 60s. There's a natural cycle to life. And now you say, well, come on, you're making all this up with the image. It's not what the dreamer thinks. This was wild. I was in Buffalo the other night lecturing, and I was trying to make an example. I said, well, the dreamer doesn't know, right? They didn't know about cards. It's the lungfish. And I said to this, I pointed someone in the group, to a woman. I said, okay, do you know what your gallbladder is doing right now? She said, I don't have one. That is true. The one person in a room of 100 people, talk about negative intuitions on that. She said, I don't have it. I had to remove a couple years ago. I said, okay. What do you have? What organs do you have that we could talk about? It's terrible, right? I'm really a Vermonter. With this kind of humor, I'm a Vermonter, right? So anyway, I was making the point. You don't know what the organs are doing. You don't know what the sugar levels are doing right now unless you're pretty sensitive to it. You don't know the different blood things going on. It's happening autonomously. This is a beautiful world of self-organizing systems that I've been seeking for 25 years. This is the world of innate organizing principles. That's brilliant stuff. Not mine. The people that discovered it is brilliant. We have a chance to partake of that feast. So, you're right. The dreamer, so if you're going to come now and you're going to be the consultant and the coach to the writer, you're going to tell him, number one, the dreamer has to know how to play the hand. Because what would the tendency be of playing his hand? If you got a royal flush and you don't know about cards, but you do know it's the best, what would you do automatically?
The tendency is to overbet.
You overbet. You say, you know, here's my house, here's my credit card. Here's my firstborn. Take everything. Because I'm going to win. Now, what happens to everybody else if you do that? You know what? I think it's kind of late. I'm going to go home right now. I'm out of the game. And so what happens to your hand? You get nothing. You get nothing. Well, but I get the best thing. I get 5 cents out of this pot. And you would say to them, if I say to you, hey, Dave, look, I got $2 from this hand, and this is the best hand? And you would say what to me? If I played it, I put my credit card on the table, $1,000, what would you say to me then?
Oops.
Yeah, but if you would, what would you say about what I did?
You played the handball.
Beautiful. Excellent. Now, again, I want to go back and forth. Who were you to say you played it wrong? It's conjecture. Is that conjecture or fact? If the goal of a card game is to win and to play the best you can, isn't the same in life that whatever hand we're dealt with, we want to do the best we can with it? It's not about money and that kind of profiting. Profiting means being able to make something of what we have and make even more of it. Isn't that what life is about, what we want for our kids? Have the best life possible, honey, you know, and I hope you do really well with your abilities. Whatever hand it is, learn how to play your hand. Maybe you, like my boy's really, he's a natural artist. And, you know, I said, learn how to play your hand as an artist. It's going to be a different world than not being a doctor or a lawyer or an attorney or a car mechanic. You're an artist. It seems to be that's your thing. There's a way to play that hand. So the image is a perfect image to say a number of things here to the dreamer. Now, there's a curve. Let's see if you pick it up. It's telling a number of things. Number one is, it's using a metaphor, an image, that describes the best thing possible that you could have received in the game of life. This is somebody that has what? An incredible destiny, an incredible fate. However, as we hear from Dave and other people that know about cards, you need to know how to play it. I grew up with people that were so smart, I thought, man, I can't do nothing compared to these people. They look how smart they are, like a natural. Joey Shimolowski always got 95s in school and great, and here I got whatever I got. And I said, well, what do they do with it? And it was a different kind of creativity, a different kind of ability. I wish to God I had a mentor when I was young that understood my particular kind of psyche. I was fortunate to find that when I was 27 years old. And my mentor, you read his book, The Way of the Image. He was my mentor almost 30 years. He looked at my life and somehow he had a sense of what the destiny was for me. Can anybody know that? There are occasions in our life when we have the gift of being with somebody who knows something really profound about us. It's one of the greatest gifts in life. And this dream is saying that not only does a dreamer have this gift, it also tells them they need to have a real set of abilities and knowledge in order to play this. You can't just go in like a little kid betting the house. Because you're not going to profit. So the image of making money would translate here to being able to profit by whatever it is that nature, God, destiny gave you. It's very specific. This is all part of the dream image. Now, Dave, who are the others that know about cards here? They know quite a bit. Oh, you do, yeah? poker. I saw a thing on TV recently about the poker tournaments, and they wear the googly eyes. I couldn't believe it. They wear these sunglasses. You can't even see their eyes. But I was going to give it away. With the way I talked about this dream, and I said it in a very quiet way, believe it or not, I was quiet about something. You're going to work with this dream as a card consultant. Is there anything that also stands out to you about this card game? Aside from what Dave said, the royal flush, know how to play it, the best hand. There's something that's very subtle here. What's your name?
Jacqueline.
Jacqueline. Anything else that you catch in this? You don't have to. That's not the right answer.
Playing with your friends versus playing with strangers?
No.
They don't turn in without her asking.
I can hear you. Ah, thank you. Say it again louder, please.
They don't turn in without her asking.
Okay, Jacqueline?
Yes.
Talk to me. If you're playing by the rules of cards, and this scene happened, and we find out that they dealt her in without her being part of the game, talk to me. What do you call that?
What do I call that?
What does one call that in the world of cards? She wasn't part of the game, and they just dealt her anyway.
And she doesn't get the cards then, right?
What do you call it? Huh?
It's a
misdeal. It's a
misdeal.
Sorry, Charlie. Okay, so you got a misdeal. So what would you do? Actually, this is... I was watching TV last night before going to bed. They had a baseball game, and you see the thing about one player, they thought he went too far, he broke his wrist in the game, and they really thought he really struck out. And then he said, no, he didn't do it. And then he got up next, and the next pitch hit a home run, and the game was over because of this. Well, imagine if he really did break his wrist and really struck out. So here, she's ready to bet the house and all this. If you then say, Miss Steele, what happens to that hand?
Dead.
Loud, please. What happened?
You just take it back or something new?
You take it back. You say, Miss Steele, this hand doesn't count. Wait a minute, I got a royal flush. You're going to take this away from me? That's not me. The dealer has to take it away. Okay, Michael, you're really taking this way too far. You're getting really, really concrete about this. Am I getting concrete, or am I trying to understand the image on its own terms? This is a profound, profound dream about destiny and about spirit and about life. Why is it a misdeal? Because she was not in the game. Not being in the game translates to what? You're not in the game of life. This is somebody that would go from flower to flower, relationship to relationship, whatever, was never committed. Now, those of you that know a little bit about archetypes, this is the classic Peter Pan syndrome. They never committed anywhere. Oh, I'm going to learn the piano, then the guitar, then the violin, and then this, and I'm going to be a little bit, I'm going to speak a little Italian, a little Hebrew, a little French. And I got some friends like this. They could do it. They could say a couple of words in every language under the sun. A little Swahili. They don't know nothing. I mean, they really never committed themselves. If you think of life is about a commitment to something that's important. Diversity is wonderful. But the archetype of the Pooer is one who touches and lands in many places. But they don't land anywhere seriously enough.
Could we take a short break?
Yeah, you want to take a break? Okay. Okay, take a break. Okay, we're taking a break. How long you want a break for? We're going to finish the story, so please. 2 minutes of filming left, apparently, so we got to talk real fast.
I understand that you will be signing books.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
You'll be signing books after tomorrow?
Yeah, I'd be happy. If anybody wants, I'd be happy to sign books. And yeah, Yeah, the one, the feel, form, and fate, and weigh the image are very much about the working with images and innate ordering processes. The other book is really interesting about initial conditions. So I would, initial conditions and how it's about the archetype of beginning. It's interesting. I wrote it when I first put it together. When I first did the draft of it, I thought this is going to be a very simple book about first sessions and all that. And I realized, my God, it took me into the inception of life itself when you study the morphogenetic codes and all that. It was an incredible journey. A little sidebar before we get back into the story, before I finish the story, is I don't know if you, some of you in the audience have heard this, but there was a recent discovery in Brooklyn about the original version of Narcissus, the book. You know, remember Ovid's Narcissus? Remember the beautiful reflection episode? Right? When Narcissus looks in a pool for the first time? Well, the Brooklyn version is a little different. But they just found it was really, it's very touching. And so, he, you know, he looks in it and he says, oh, man. He says, who is that beautiful youth? And the reflection says, what's a youth? What? From my cousin Vinny, right? What a youth. He said, no. He said, you are a youth. He said, I'm not a youth. I'm your reflection. And then they have this big argument back and forth. Like, well, everybody in Brooklyn, they argue about everything. And he finally says, and then the lines come, am I to woo you or you to woo me? He said, what do you mean woo? It's a, so it's a new version just came out. So just check it out when you get a chance. And another little sidebar is, if you're interested in this work, actually there's a senior member of our community, Deb Greenwood, that's living in Olympia. It's not Olympia, it's Tacoma, who's in our training program. So if anybody's interested in putting together some kind of groups or something at some point, you may want to think about contacting Deb. She's really great in looking at archetypal dynamics. Okay, the story. So we find out now there's a missed deal, right? There's a missed deal. Again, you can say, well, you're being awfully literal and all that. Whether you agree or not, okay, what I'm seeking to do is to stay in the world of the image as the image is presented. I didn't make up a missed deal. So as we, if you stay within the storyline, in the field of cards, in the field of royal flush, in the field of just dealing somebody in when they're not part of the game, it's crucial to what we do with this image. So when you say missed deal, what does it mean about that hand? You're a dealer. You happen to be a dealer. So what does it mean about the hand? And I got this beautiful hand. What are you going to do to me now?
Sorry. We're going to go on the next hand. You don't have to do it anymore.
Well, that stinks. So here you got this incredible, the best hand imaginable. And one woman asked me, did I know what suit it was in the dream? Clubs, hearts. That wasn't clear in the dream. But, yeah. So anyway, what do we now do? How do we translate this? You understand the difference between, or beginning understanding, the difference between interpretation and translation? With the translation, you're staying with the image itself. Let me just finish and then get your question. If you say it's a missed deal and the cards go back, what is it you say to the dream about this incredible destiny? That it's not yours anymore? Huh? Wow. Well, forfeit would imply what? What's the central issue, huh? Would that fit, Deb, in terms of the ontology of forfeit? I don't think it would be forfeit. I think it's something more unfortunate, yeah. Forfeited. Well, you'd have to give it up. So,
it is possible.
What is?
To get it again.
Yes. This is in some ways... In some ways, it's a little bit like the Grail legend, in that you see it, you can't have it, and you spend the rest of your life knowing it. It's also incredible knowing that this was something you had. And it's also something one has to mourn. I remember I debated whether to present this dream as I was preparing for this lecture, because when I here 3 years ago, a woman in the audience got upset with that. She said, oh, my God, how mean to take it away. I said, I didn't take anything away. she accused me. And it was, I understood. I mean, this is a rough dream. However, you're right. I mean, now, what are the odds of getting a royal flush again? Huh? 1 in 5?
It depends on how much you participate.
Well, it's still, no matter what, it's still like having one in 500,000 odds. You can't get it. However,
depends what psyche wants to say to
you. Yeah, what?
Depends what your psyche wants to say to you.
Yeah, yeah. But this is huge because it's saying, we'll get the question in a minute. This fellow has one first, but let me just finish the story because the film's running out too. That it's saying that you had an incredible hand. However, because of the fact you were not in life enough, there is, maybe I'll say forfeit, maybe it's the right word, I don't know for sure, that there's something you have to give up. And that's, there's a mourning that goes with that. Now, it doesn't mean you can't have a great life. I mean, that's to know that this is part of your life and part of your destiny may be that you had to see this incredible thing, and we can't all bring everything to fruition. We know that. But to realize, and, you know, the dream happened when the dream was about early 40s. It's a time when there's a serious reflection that comes in our life. When we begin to say, you know what, those things can come to fruition, some things may not come to fruition. That's real. To say, you know, these plants on the vine, these things, these tomatoes can still come to life. They still can come to maturity. Other ones won't. It's a huge moral and spiritual reckoning. And to come to grips with some unretrievable losses. Now, it doesn't mean that it still can't be a wonderful life. What my job was as a translator, and hopefully some of you could begin to see how I'm working with this. My job was to say that you were given the most unimaginable gift possible. Because you were not in life, there was something that may not come to fruition. Many things still will. However, I do want to teach you what it's like to play that hand. And we talked about betting. Like if somebody has that hand, you're right. You're going to bet the house right away, and you're going to throw everybody out. And I translated that to her by saying, look, you do have incredible abilities. This dream is saying that you were born with something incredible. And the good fortune to be given this, even though you can't play it out right now, you need to be with the best of the best. No matter what you do in your career, you need to be with the best. You don't go to any just hack, any cook, any chef. Go to the best chefs. You get a Michelin 4-star, whatever they're called. You get the best. You want to learn to cook fish? Go to the best fish cooks around, the best fish chefs. You want to make pizza? Make the best in the world. Go to Naples and make incredible pizza. You want to be an analyst? You find the best people at the institute and you study your tail off with them. You have this in your cards. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, you know, for me to have to see that dream, to see the exquisite sensitivity of the psyche, to find the one image to capture both the incredible ability one was gifted with at life and also the consequences of being out of life. And, you know, I think you know what I mean by being out of life. Again, it's just not really being engaged. And we could do that very well, to not be engaged.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.